die here. We built this house.
We're not going over.
We're not going anywhere. We're going to die here.
Longtime Sutton residents ride out the rising river. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Girdwood residents look for policing alternatives as state troopers plan to pull service from the community.
They are in the municipality of Anchorage. You know, I certainly feel that the municipality of Anchorage has an obligation to provide police services there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Defendants in the Sockeye wildfire case were no shows in state court in Palmer this morning. The state is seeking a conviction against Greg Immig and Amy DeWitt, who are charged with 8 misdemeanor counts ranging from illegal burning to reckless endangerment as a result of the fire that consumed more than 50 homes in the Willow area. Immig and DeWitt waived their right to an arraignment late Monday. Their attorneys filed not guilty pleas for both. No victims of the fire appeared in court today, although Cherise Miller, a paralegal with the Palmer District Attorney's Office, says the state is trying to locate them.
Anyone affected by the fire, I need them to be contacting the District Attorney's Office so that they can be getting us their information. We're obviously reaching out, but it is very hard. We have been reaching out by sending letters. I think we're through about 30 of them, but this takes immense research because a lot of the properties were just wrecked properties, so there was no buildings on them.
Miller says restitution for victims can be ordered by the court up to 90 days after the end of the trial. The next proceeding is a pre-trial hearing set for Immig and DeWitt on August 21st in Palmer. The dramatic surge of the Matanuska River during the past few days has pushed families from some homes and is continuing to threaten others. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, although a few remaining homeowners are in a wait-and-see mode, one venerable homesteading couple says they won't budge.
Department of Transportation trucks are scattered along the Glen Highway north of Sutton while surveyors pull equipment out to the roadside and inspectors walk the right-of-way. Late Monday, DOT agreed to send in emergency crews to the area to start immediate work to protect the Glen from the spreading waters of the Matanuska River. 3 homes have been abandoned, 1 has tumbled into the river, and the waters have reached the back porches of 3 other houses. Mike Pearson lives in a barn-style greenhouse close to the highway, but the blue-gray water is puddling up in his backyard. I wade across to where he stands looking toward the river.
You're not evacuating, I take it?
No, not yet. my poor neighbors are just been devastated.
Pearson says he's hanging tough for a while at least.
You can see how the pressure is pushing the water up. This is the river water behind us right here. Look how far down the river is there. So you can see the amount of pressure that's being pushed up into this.
Do you ever see anything like this before?
Not this bad. I mean, you've seen the river come up and I've seen a little water, but nothing this high.
Pearson has lived on his property for 35 years. He says the Braided River is looking for a natural place to go and glacial melt is feeding the waters. Pearson says when he moved in, his house was about a mile from the river and that erosion has slowly eaten the land away. He blames both Mother Nature and the dikes that the Matanuska Susitna Burrow built in the river years ago to try to control its flow. He says he's still got 20 feet of ground left, and that gives him time to think about it. Further up the highway, Ed Musial, 92, and wife Val, 88, are calmly eating breakfast when I knock on the door. Their well-kept home looks high and dry from the road, but on closer inspection, there is very little dry ground between their back door and the edge of the riverbank. They have lived in the area since the 1950s and in the home they built in 1982 since then.
Tell me what your plan is. Are you going to stay here?
We plan to die here. We built this house.
We're not going over.
We're not going anywhere. We're going to die here.
How much land do you think is between that door and the cliff?
3 feet.
So you've got still 3 feet of land?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't bother you?
No. This house ain't moving nowhere.
Ed Musial used to work construction. He says his concrete block basement is so heavy, the river won't budge it or his house. But the Musials, too, say dikes put in by the borough in the 1980s could have caused the current problem.
It's been happening for years, ever since they blew out those dikes. The river has been coming in and coming in and coming in. The last couple of days, those people down there really got it. But we've been fighting this river since 86.
You don't have a whole lot to fight from. I mean, I can see...
Well, we used to, you know.
How far was it?
I used to have a 50-foot clothesline in the backyard, and then we had a one-lane road back there. Then there was an embankment. Then there was this Yellow Creek, the salmon-spawning stream. Then there was woods, and the river was way to hell over there.
Val Musial says they will hang on to the 3 feet of land between their house and the river. Neighbors have offered them shelter. They have a daughter in Eagle River, but they plan to tough it out. Borough officials announced today that those affected by the river erosion still have time to file for a federal buyout program that could pay them for their property. In Sutton, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
At the end of the year, Alaska State Troopers say they will close their post in Girdwood. As KSKA's Monica Goki reports, the town's quest to court a new source of law enforcement is off to a rocky start.
The town of Girdwood is involved in what some might see as a really unfortunate game of hot potato. Girdwood is the potato, and the two parties hoping not to get stuck with it are the Anchorage Police Department and the Alaska State Troopers. Due to statewide budget cuts, troopers notified the town of 2,600 year-round residents that they'd no longer be able to provide law enforcement starting next year. Troopers Director Colonel James Cockrell.
You know, we're losing 5 trooper positions on the Kenai Peninsula, and it's essentially resource-related.
And furthermore,
they are in the municipality of Anchorage. You know, I certainly feel that the municipality of Anchorage has an obligation to provide them police services there.
Losing the troopers is really bad news for Girdwood because, well, the troopers were free. Like Colonel Cockrell says, though, Girdwood technically falls within the municipality of Anchorage, but the town has to pay for Anchorage Police Department patrols. Sam Daniel is on the Girdwood Board of Supervisors, which is sort of like a town council. They've taken on this issue, but they're finding that APD doesn't police the same way the troopers do.
If we were to keep the state troopers in Girdwood, then the state troopers model allows for one officer and one car to be on duty. APD, as I understand it, both the union and the municipality require that each officer have their own car and that there be a minimum of 2 officers on shift.
If you look at the trooper incident logs for Girdwood the past few years, you mostly see a lot of speeding tickets, some reckless driving citations, and a handful of DUIs. Crime stats portray it as a pretty safe place, which is why the Girdwood board is asking for just one Anchorage police officer on the weekends. But so far, the answer is no. Paying for police service is not an a la carte type of purchase. Here's how City Manager Mike Abbott put it to the Girdwood board at a working session on Monday.
The police department doesn't feel like they can provide that sort of level of service that you've described. That they're both from a staffing point of view as well as from the way they're organized and the way they're trained and the way they currently operate, that doesn't fit with how they provide police service in Anchorage. So they, at this point, their recommendation is that they not be tasked with that assignment. Now, they're not the final decision makers on that.
If Girdwood wants to buy into full APD coverage, it would mean an added tax through a voter-approved mill rate. And Sam Daniel says the price tag is considerable.
It's maybe a 30% increase to the property taxpayers.
The earliest Girdwood could even vote on such a tax would be next April. And if they can't extend trooper coverage in the meantime, it means APD will cover Girdwood, but only on a very sparse, emergency-only kind of basis.
It would only be for major crimes, such as an officer down or a shooting or something like this.
For now, Girdwood is exploring a number of different options. There's talk of a neighborhood watch. They've even cast a line to Whittier about contract policing. In Anchorage, the city is lending its resources and pitching Girdwood's case to the governor to keep troopers on the job. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
Another member of Anchorage's homeless community died early this morning. It's the 6th such death in the last 2 weeks. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Lisa Souter is the executive director of Beans Cafe. She says the organization was notified this morning that a client had passed away overnight.
She was found unresponsive on the sidewalk on 3rd Avenue near Beans Cafe. It's a devastating loss for our staff and volunteers and clients to lose six people in this short of a time frame.
Emergency personnel responded to a cardiac arrest call around 3 a.m. Tuesday at 3rd and Carluck near Beans Cafe. The deceased has not been publicly identified yet, but Souter says she was well known among Beans Cafe staff and other clients and volunteers of the shelter.
We worked with her extensively, and, you know, it's very sad to lose someone, no matter what the circumstances. This, for many reasons, was particularly tragic for us. And our thoughts and prayers go out to her friends and family.
Souter says it's alarming to lose such a large number of people in the homeless community in such a short span of time, especially during the summer.
I think it should cause a lot of concern among the entire community, because ultimately this is a community issue, and Beans Cafe cannot address it alone. We really need the entire community to help us and to bring forth solutions and assistance.
Souter says in light of the homeless deaths, she has met with the mayor's office to form a plan to address the problem. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kivalina residents celebrate the opening of a new town store.
The store is going to be very important to have. If we don't have the capability of hunting the foods that we normally do,
that's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's big energy policy bill, if it passes, would be the first in years. Several national energy bills have washed up on the rocks since then. Murkowski's strategy is to keep controversies out of the package, and as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, it was tested at a Senate hearing this morning.
Going into the meeting, Murkowski, chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, faced a stack of 94 proposed amendments to the bill. Murkowski and Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, the top Democrat on the committee, all but pleaded with the other senators not to stuff the bill with features that might become poison pills. Murkowski warned that she'd vote against even amendments she favors if she thought they'd sink the bill.
I would hope that members would instead choose to offer and withdraw some of these amendments to help preserve this bipartisan work product.
The practice of offer and withdraw allows a senator to go on record and make a speech about an amendment without disrupting the process. And that was largely the order of the day. The committee cleared 25 amendments in part one of the markup process. One of the amendments that did get a vote was Democratic Senator Al Franken's push for energy efficiency standards for power and gas utilities.
If we are really serious about telling ourselves and the country that we are serious about reducing the amount of carbon we put into the atmosphere, if we are, this is a way to do it.
Franken of Minnesota says more than 20 states have already adopted efficiency standards, and they've been very successful. Murkowski says the laws should remain at the state level.
We talk about the states being the laboratories. That's the way it should be. I am concerned, though, that if we have a new federal mandate, a requirement, that what you then do is you upend the good work that comes out of the states.
Franken appeared frustrated. He says if the states are the laboratories for Congress on this, the lab results are in already.
Why don't we take yes for an answer? Why don't we take it works for an answer?
His amendment failed along party lines. Sponsors withdrew other amendments relating to rural community subsidies, alternative energy, and permits for cross-border pipelines. At the end of the day, nothing controversial was attached to the bill, but several senators say they'll raise theirs again on the Senate floor, assuming the bill passes the committee. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The statewide wildfire response that's been operating at peak for more than a month is ramping down. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, wet weather over areas of the interior has calmed many fires.
Heavy rain showers have pelted areas of the interior over the last few days, a weather pattern that's replaced the hot, dry conditions that allowed numerous lightning-caused blazes to grow earlier in the month. Alaska Division of Forestry spokesman Tim Mowry says the shift in conditions in many areas has dampened fire activity enough to allow downsizing the suppression operation.
We have a massive demobilization program going on right now with all the resources we sent out to a lot of these fires are now in the process of going back. You know, hoses, equipment, all that goes to the warehouses and is refurbed. And we've got crews timing out and heading back to the lower 48.
Mowry says the peak force of over 3,000 firefighters has been cut in half, adding that Alaska-based crews are being prioritized for work. While many areas have received enough rain to stop fires, Mowry says that's not the case everywhere.
The farther north and west you go, the less rain there is. I mean, a lot of the activity right now is in that Hughes and Tanana area in northwest interior. There's still a lot of heat and a lot of fire activity there, and that stretches now over, you know, onto the Seward Peninsula and up into the Noatak River Valley areas, you know, which is much farther west, and there's some fires that have started up there as a result of lightning here recently that we've deployed smoke jumpers on.
There are still 285 wildfires that are considered active in the state, with 19 of those staffed. Mowry cautions that even wildfires where activity has slowed substantially will continue to get attention.
A lot of these fires, they're still going to have people working on them potentially through the end of August or even later, depending on the weather.
Mowry says some of that work involves rehabilitating fire line, in some cases turning it into trails or access points. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
It's been a festive day in the Northwest Arctic community of Kivalina as residents celebrate the grand opening of a new store. It's an end to 8 months of struggle with limited supplies after Kivalina's store burned to the ground on December 5th. Janet Mitchell is Kivalina's city administrator. She says the village doesn't have firefighting equipment, so men cut a hole in the ice of the local lagoon and pumped water on the fire, mainly to keep it from spreading to nearby teacher housing. Mitchell says a temporary store was established, but it was a very small space.
They ran out of things very quick, and that posed a difficulty for young babies or young families that need formula.
Mitchell says eggs cost more than $8 a dozen, and pilot bread was $7 because supplies were so limited. Mitchell says a temporary store was in a storage structure built in the early 1900s and mainly sold staples of eggs, flour, and rice. She says Seattle-based Alaska Native Industries Cooperative Association, or ANICA, owns the store. She says the new store is two or three times bigger than the old structure, and today, company officials flew in for the grand opening, serving hamburgers and hot dogs to the community. Kivalina's population of 468 has a high percentage of young people. Janet Mitchell says close to half are 18 or under, and many of the young people don't care for traditional foods. Subsistence resources are also harder to get in a changing climate. Mitchell says the ice went out in early June, and with it went the subsistence mainstay, ugruk, or bearded seal.
It's our winter food. That we didn't have an opportunity to hunt the bearded seal. So it's going to be a very, very lean year in terms of native foods.
Mitchell says her large extended family normally harvests between 15 and 20 large adult males seals. This year they got one small seal. She says less than 20 have been harvested by the entire community, and they haven't seen many caribou either. She says even older Kivalina residents who normally rely heavily on subsistence hunting will now have to include more Western food in their diet.
The store is going to be very important to have if we don't have the capability of hunting the foods that we normally do, we're going to need the foods from the store.
Mitchell says her community continues to fight development to protect subsistence food, but the store will be increasingly important in the future.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Broken hips and head injuries can have life-altering effects, especially for older adults. But no matter how old you are, it's important to be physically active to prevent injuries. Activity can also increase your strength, balance, and can be done at any age. Ask your healthcare provider about activities that will improve your health. Learn more about starting a new activity at injuryprevention.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Teacher training usually means spending time in a library with textbooks and PowerPoints. But for 13 Alaska educators, earlier this month, it meant hopping on a helicopter, donning crampons, and toting an ice axe on top of the Mendenhall Glacier as part of Discovery Southeast's teacher expedition. KTOO's Lisa Fu was invited to tag along and has more on taking lessons from the glacier back to the classroom.
From the Juneau Airport, less than 10 minutes fly by before the helicopter lands on the ice of the Mendenhall Glacier.
I look at this every day.
Bev Levine works at the glacier's visitor center.
Now I'm actually seeing it, touching it, being on it, and it's really cool and kind of surreal in a way.
The glacier expedition is just one of several teacher trips that Discovery Southeast offers in the summer. Teachers pay tuition to learn in an outdoor classroom for a week and can get continuing education credits from the University of Alaska Southeast. Richard Karstensen is one of the founders of the outdoor education nonprofit and an instructor.
This is our backyard in Juneau.
Of the 13 teachers on the glacier expedition, most are from Juneau.
And they're going to bring this back to their classes, even if they can't actually walk the kids around on the ice. It's going to just give them a much more full body understanding of what this glacier's doing.
Kathy Connor is a retired geology professor at UAS and another expedition instructor.
If you teach teachers, you teach the world. You know, if you just teach kids, that's a flash in the pan. They're the parade moving, but teachers are your pivot point. They're the railway station that all the trains come through.
During the expedition, teachers were supposed to spend 3 days on the Juneau ice field. Due to weather, ice time was limited to the day on the Mendenhall Glacier. Matt Potter says the days spent off the ice were just as rewarding. Potter is in the process of moving from Anchorage to Circle, where he'll be the lead teacher.
We hiked up somewhere and there was this gravel pile, and we had a bunch of 5-gallon buckets, and we dumped water down it just to look at what the effect of concentrated runoff is, how it sorts out the rocks from the gravel, from the silt. It was a really good hands-on activity to show in real time the processes of erosion. And I think that's something that no matter how old you are, you're going to have fun dumping water down a hill, right?
But it's the glacier that draws the most awe.
There's just nowhere else on Earth like this. It's
Allie Smith teaches at Juneau's Auk Bay Elementary School.
And the one thing that I'm so amazed with today is just watching all the melt streams on the surface of the glacier. I always knew there was melting, but there's a lot more channels and dynamics to see up here than I realized.
Throughout the day, the instructors pose this question to the group of teachers.
Do you guys have any ideas on what you might take to your classrooms about the process that's happening out here?
The teachers have some ideas, like using algebra to predict snow accumulation and ablation cycles, nature walks in areas where the glacier once was, experiments that model how ice carves away at cliff sides. But they have weeks before school starts, so while they're on the glacier, they might as well goof off for a few minutes. Palmer teacher Nicholas Owens stands over a small glacial river.
Well, we're gonna, this is a very technical thing we're doing here. We're gonna drop the orange in,
We should probably measure something off our eyeball measurement, and then we're going to calculate how fast the water's flowing.
Okay, on your mark. Get set. Go. Oh, no.
Eddie out. It's in the eddy.
The orange is stuck in the eddy.
In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Each of the hundreds of vessels in the Bristol Bay fleet burns through several nets catching sockeye each summer. Many rely on net hanging shops to assemble their sturdy gill nets. As the season was winding down, KDLG's Hannah Colton stopped by one quirky shop that's becoming a mainstay in the knack-knack net scene.
What's It To Ya Net Shop is many things, including a quiet respite for one weary fisherman who is in the corner napping on beanbags that owner Marcia Dale had brought out.
I'll tell you, I drop them down and I try to take a nap sometimes. Even 20 minutes helps after a million hours of hanging.
Dale hung nets for about 100 fishermen this summer. She rarely relents from her work.
I can get in a really nice rhythm. It's almost meditating. It is. It's like meditation.
What's It To Ya was started over 30 years ago in the back of a friend's net locker. Dale carved out windows to let in the sun and a view of boats on the Naknek River. Eventually, the Leader Creek cannery was built up around her. Now, when fishermen go to What's It To Ya, they know to bring their own web and their manners.
Basically, let's see, I can't use any bad words on this. If they need too much babysitting, if they whine, if they're not grateful, if they're disrespectful, or bring us crappy lines, because I can't hang a line that I think is going to come apart in the water, and sometimes they don't want to spend money on a good line. And they also have to have a sense of humor, or they're out.
Marcia Dale will be back next April to tie sturdy knots and to keep fishermen afloat. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Sutton, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.